You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Andrea Bartz is my guest this week. She is a journalist and has been an editor in a few magazines, and is the author of the book Stuff Hipsters Hate, A Field Guide to the Passionate Opinions of the Indifferent. And now Andrea Bartz has written her first novel, and it's a good one. It's a thriller called The Lost Night. Andrea Bartz, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Andy, since your book is a thriller, why don't you tell us what you want our listeners to know about The Lost Night? I don't want to be responsible for any spoilers.
All right. Yeah, I also have to remind myself not to give away any spoilers when I talk about the book. But The Lost Night, as you said, it's a thriller, and it's about a woman who's sort of uncovering the dark truth surrounding her best friend's apparent suicide in a Brooklyn loft 10 years earlier. So to give a little bit more detail, back in 2009, our main character, Lindsay, was 23 years old and had kind of this tight-knit group of friends who were partying their way through Brooklyn in the middle of the recession and sort of that interesting time in New York. And the nerve center of sort of their social life was a building called Calhoun Lofts. And it was a refurbished warehouse that now had all of these kind of artist lofts, these crummy artist lofts that were cheap and filled with people doing all sorts of, you know, young people doing all sorts of creative things. And you could walk in on any given Friday night without an agenda, and you could find a poetry reading going on in one loft, and an EDM dance party in another, and a jam session in another, and concerts, and you would sort of, you know, get separated from your friends and have a whole adventure, and then in the morning catch up with everyone and sort of compare notes. And so one Friday night, like any other, Lindsay and her friends are, you know, partying in different parts of the building. And that same night, sort of the group's ringleader and Lindsay's best friend, Edie, is found in her loft with a suicide note on her computer and a bullet in her head. And it's horrible, and the group kind of scatters and moves on. And the lost night picks up 10 years later when Lindsay is in her 30s. She is a magazine fact checker, and she thinks she's really left this all in the past. But then a chance encounter sort of leads her to uncover some evidence that suggests not only that it might not have been a suicide, but that she herself may have been involved. And her memories from the night are a little unclear, seeing as there was, you know, some alcohol-fueled partying at the time. So she begins to dig into what really happened. And the more she digs, sort of the more secrets come to light. And so she's really playing detective with her own life.
Well, your book, Andrea Bartz, your book, Stuff Hipsters Hate, makes a cameo in appearance in The Lost Night, which that made me giggle. And I thought, you know, so how much of your own life did you draw upon when you were creating the atmosphere for The Lost Night?
Yeah, so that's funny you caught the cameo. A lot of people miss that. But, you know, I myself was 23 in 2009, and I was living in, you know, North Brooklyn. And it felt like we didn't know it at the time, but it definitely felt like sort of a moment for this subculture, right? For the quote-unquote hipster subculture. And with the benefit of hindsight, I think what was happening was that we were graduating right in the middle of the Great Recession, which we didn't see coming. And so we went to college thinking we were going to get our degrees, we were going to get good jobs, and then we were going to continue on the path just like our parents had before us. And then right as we got sort of dumped into the real world, the bottom fell out from under us. And so it was horrible, but, you know, we were 22, 23. We didn't have retirement funds that shrunk to nothing. We didn't have mortgages that we were trying to pay. And so I think sort of the reaction was, well, there's no money anyway, so we're just going to create. We're going to, you know, everyone had Tumblrs, and everyone had, everyone was a photographer, and everyone was in a band, and everyone was, you know, writing poetry and printing zines. And so it was this really kind of best of times and worst of times. It was a lot of fun, even though we sort of were dancing as the world burned. And yeah, so at the time, actually, a friend and I, Brenna Ehrlich, had started a blog sort of skewering the hipster scene, even as we felt like we were inside of it, and that was Stuff Hipsters Hate. And our blog was what led to that sort of nonfiction humor book. But I absolutely was drawing on my own life in terms of some of those details of some of those parties and some of those characters and, you know, some of those quirky people you would meet on any given Friday night. And I wanted to ultimately sort of capture a moment in time that now, 10 years later, it feels feels like a different era and it feels deep in the past. But at the time I was writing it, it was really only a few years out. So it sort of developed as I kept working on the book.
So it's kind of a memoir with a death, a mysterious death thrown in just to make us more interested.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, Lindsay and I have a lot of massive differences. But I think as with any good novelist, there's going to be some things that are ripped from real life and some things that are, you know, details that came from real life. But really the whole story has little in common with my own years in New York.
Well, you use the phrase with the benefit of hindsight in that last little paragraph of yours. And I was thinking about, you know, your book is a mystery and that's the heart of the plot. But equally intriguing to me was the idea of a person coming to the age for the first time in their lives when they can look back a decade at their own lives and feel the passage of time and friendships and habits and loves and hates. So was that one of the things you wanted to write about?
I definitely thought that there was something interesting and special about being 22 or 23 that wasn't unique to me having graduated in 2008. And there was something for a lot of people that is special and almost like a second adolescence. Of finishing college and being out on your own in a city for the first time and just feeling like the world is yours, like the world is your oyster. You have sort of this invincibility because you don't have much life experience yet. And so you feel like you can, you know, you're totally on your own and you're not on a conveyor belt anymore with somebody sort of telling you what to do. And so I wanted to capture that feeling and that invincibility and also just the drama of it. Everything feels so enormous and important when you're 22 or 23 and your friends are everything. And if you're having a fight with someone, that's everything. And if you, you know, are dating someone new, it's so, so, you know, huge in your mind and sort of operatic. And yeah, with the benefit of hindsight, I was able to sort of look back and look back with sort of some kindness and I think some forgiveness of toward my own early 20s and towards myself and, you know, some of the dumb things I did because I was too young to know better. And also some of the dumb things that, you know, friends and romantic interests and that kind of thing were doing. Because now as a 30-something, I can look back and say, you know, everyone was doing the best that they could. But at the time, everything felt extremely personal and extremely, you know, important. So, but I do think that there is something about, like I said, the early 20s that's not unique to me in that experience in 2009, because I've had several people who are about a decade older than me who've read and reviewed the book, and in doing so, state that it's a book about a group of 20-somethings partying in New York in the 90s. And, you know, I see that, and the drama takes place in 2009. So they're a solid 10-plus years off, but I think people are sort of recognizing in that so some of those descriptions, like their own time when you're 22 or 23 and invincible and making some stupid decisions and kind of learning, fumbling your way through early adulthood.
Right. I mean, your novel actually takes place, like, right now.
As
I was reading it, it was like, oh, this is today. I mean, because the date that showed up was actually the date that I was reading the thing. But
oh, funny.
Yeah. When I look back on my, you know, 20s, you know, I think about when, you know, I remember when gasoline, you know, went up to a dollar, you know, and candy bars went up to 25 cents. And you look back to your 20s and it's MP3s and the iPod Shuffle. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's funny because we all, as we look back in 10 years, you know, you look back at your 30s and, oh, you know, I was so young. And then in your 50s, you say, oh, in my 40s, I was just a child.
Right.
It never ends. I don't think it ever ends.
Yeah, yeah. But I think technology especially is sort of an interesting way to mark the passage of time. And this wasn't necessarily part of my plan when I began writing, but setting the sort of backstory in 2009 and then the front story in 2019, it set up this, you know, obviously if Lindsay doesn't have clear memories of what went on, her only way to get information is to talk to people, get their memories, and also to check old technology. And as you said, there's, you know, the iPod shuffles, and there's an old hard drive, and there's a flip cam, and there's sort of these piecemeal pieces of technology that we had as ways of documenting things. And so it sort of pointed out this contrast between 2009, where most of us didn't have smartphones yet. Social media wasn't that big yet. We were just sort of on this precipice where today we record absolutely everything. You know, we're all sort of documentarians all the time, and we weren't yet in 2009. That was a little different. And so it was kind of fun to play with that idea of how 10 years from now, if you weren't able to access sort of the pixels and bytes and technology into which you're funneling all of your memories right now, what would that mean? And there's research showing that if you document something, you don't remember it as well. If I take a photo of something, I don't remember it as well because I sort of offload the job of remembering to my iPhone or whatever. And so, you know, there's pretty good research showing that our memories are getting worse and worse as we depend on technology to do the remembering for us. And so it was sort of fun to play with that idea of, well, she doesn't quite remember what happened 10 years ago. Her memory isn't clear. And so she's going back and has to sort of jerry-rig her way into the flip cams and the digital cameras and all the sort of less complete picture that she could piece together from technology from back then.
Also, one of the main characters, I think, in your book is New York. I mean, you didn't set it in Davenport, Iowa, or Palm Springs. It's New York. What is it about New York that made you want to write about New York?
Yeah. So I myself have been in New York for 11 plus years. I moved here right after college. And so for me, the feeling of being 22 or 23 and the feeling of being in New York during all of that are very much one and the same and go hand in hand. And, you know, I think all New Yorkers feel like they're the center of the universe, right? And so compounding that with being 22 and thinking you're the center of the universe, that to me fit together very neatly. It's sort of the city of dreams, and everyone feels like their ideas are going to be the big ones and they're going to change the world. And so, yeah, to me, setting sort of that hipster scene in Brooklyn was, first of all, what I knew and what I felt like I could capture accurately, even though certainly in San Francisco and Austin, Texas, and Chicago, there's plenty of other cities that had their own sort of, you know, burgeoning artsy scenes in 2009 as well. But I really wanted to capture the city in sort of a love letter way, because I love New York and I love Brooklyn, and I hadn't seen that era sort of captured yet as a setting. And so it was a fun challenge for me.
Oh yeah. New York is a neglected city, but, the mystery in your book is really, you know, well plotted and twisty and really fun. And
thank you.
How did you, you know, are you a mystery writer? Do you feel you have a lot of other mysteries you're going to write now? Or how did you plot this little mystery?
So I've always loved mysteries. I've loved reading them. And so to me, thinking about how to get started on a manuscript of my own, it was just a given. I was going to write a thriller. I was definitely going to stay in that genre because I love the dark and the creepy, and I love twists, and it just is the most fun thing to read. So I thought it would be the most fun thing to write. What I didn't really think about is how hard it is to write a mystery and how hard it is to plot out all those twists and turns and to make the reveal surprising and to make the red herrings convincing and, you know, to reveal things at just the right time. It's a real challenge because you know, by the time you finish the manuscript, you as the author know everything. So it's really, really hard to tell to an outsider what is going to be obvious and what's going to be too subtle. And I absolutely think I have many more mysteries in me. I've written a second one, and I love this genre and want to stay in it. And in terms of how I did it, I kind of have no idea. I'm beginning now that I've written two. My next one will be out next year. Now that I've written two, I'm beginning to figure out my methods, and I'm beginning to figure out how to keep track of plot lines and character development and reveals. But this first book, I was just kind of flying by the seat of my pants, and I didn't know the ending myself until I got to it. And so a lot of the big surprises and twists, they were surprises to me as well. I would sort of write a line and then gasp, like, oh my goodness, really? So it sort of, revealed itself to me. And then I had, of course, a lot of refining to do and retrofitting things to have it all make sense. But I feel like it's a miracle of God that it somehow came together, because there were moments of doubt during the process, for sure.
Well, I like the book a lot. I think it's great, and I've been recommending it to my friends, and they like it.
Thank you.
And what kind of reception has the book got? Have you gotten some feedback?
Yeah, so the book came out in late February, and I've been quite lucky because it's gotten some really great reviews. It was called a Best Book of 2019 by Real Simple, Glamour Magazine, by Marie Claire Magazine. It has gotten starred reviews from several different, trade journals, from Library Journal and Booklist. And people seem to be liking it and letting me know, sort of like you did. And it was also optioned for TV, which was really exciting. So Cartel Entertainment and Mila Kunis' production company, Apple Orchard Farms production, as I say it, I'm doubting myself, Mila Kunis' production company, have optioned it to develop it as a limited series for TV.
That's
really exciting to me because, a TV series would sort of give the opportunity to really develop the subplots and really sort of get into it, whereas a movie, compressing it down to 2 hours, would mean being very bare bones and getting rid of a lot of it. And then around publication, it got some really great press. It was chosen by Amazon's editors as the best book of the month, and it was in People the week it came out, which obviously was a huge sort of dream come true for me as a debut author. So, it's been really rewarding that people seem to be connecting with it, because I feel like I sort of, poured my heart and soul into it, and then you put it into book form and send it out into the world, and people can make what they will of it. So it's been pretty exciting that people seem to be sort of getting it.
So do you think in your future thrillers, mysteries, whatever we want to call them, this is a mystery for sure. Will you have recurring characters? Are you going to have your own, Miss Marple?
Yeah, so the current plan is not to do sequels or serializations. And I don't think that's going to change, because what I love writing are sort of incidental amateur detectives. So I think for the Miss Marples or the Tana French's Dublin Murder Squad or something like that, you need people who are professionals doing this, right? Like, it's their job to keep taking on mysteries. And for me, I'm most intrigued by people who the mystery falls into their lap, and for sort of character reasons and emotional reasons, they have no choice but to solve it. So currently, at least between this and the second, and I'm just starting to talk to my editor and agent about the third, there's not any talk of a series, and instead they're going to be standalone. But I guess never say never. There's hopefully still a lot of books in me.
Well, I hope that you will make From the Bookshelf a stop, and thank you so much for sending me The Lost Night. It's The Lost Night, a novel by Andrea Bartz. And Andrea, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Yeah, thank you so much, Gary. It was a pleasure.
Andrea Bartz, author of The Lost Night. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Joining me now is rock and roll photographer Henry Diltz. You may not know his name, but you have seen his work. His photographs have been used on the covers of tons of great record albums. He captured the feel of the 60s and early 70s rock scene in his work, which is now being published by Genesis Press, the exclusive British company that publishes limited edition beautiful books about rock and roll and the Beatles and all that stuff. Henry Diltz, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary.
Let me ask you, how did you go from... You started as a musician, right?
Yes, I did. In the early 60s, I was in a folk group called the Modern Folk Quartet. And we did four-part harmony folk music and had a couple albums on Warner Brothers and then some... on Dunhill, and we finally did a Phil Spector single. And it was a Harry Nilsson song called This Could Be the Night. And we waited around all summer for that song to come out and for us, you know, to finally, you know, have our careers skyrocket. And it never came out. He just wouldn't. He was at a paranoid point of his life where, you know, he wouldn't put anything out unless he knew it would be number one. And we were sort of a folk rock experiment, so it didn't come out. And so
did
we
kind of come out?
Well, it came out years later on an album called Rare Masters in England, and since that day, it has been Rodney Bingenheimer's theme song on his radio show on. Gosh, I don't know what station it is, in L.A., K-Rock maybe or something?
Let me stop you right there, because now that you've mentioned the infamous Phil Spector, I want to know what your experience in the studio with Phil Spector was like.
Well, we spent a couple of months going up to his house just about every day, and we'd get up there, you know, like if we had to be there at 1 o'clock, we'd get there at 1, and he'd usually come down the stairs about 3 o'clock. And this happened day after day, and, you know, we would play pool or, you know, walk around the gardens or whatever, you know, and then he would show up. And we'd stand around the piano, and he would play songs, and we'd sing, and he'd tell us harmonies, and then we would play instruments. We'd play our guitars and banjos, and he would get his 12-string, and we would play. So we spent a good part of the summer just kind of jamming, you know, so that he would get an idea of, you know, of our capabilities. And and then he found us this song. He said, I finally got a song for you guys. And it was really a great song, a Harry Nilsson song. And then, of course, then we went in the studio, Gold Star, and recorded with the wall of sound, you know, 7 guitars and 3 basses and 8 drummers and so on. And it was great. I played banjo on it. And, it was actually that song became one of Brian Wilson's favorite songs. You know, not because of us, but because of Phil Spector. But he came down and he sat in the control room in his robe and slippers and listened to that thing over and over and over. And that's why we were so excited, because we thought, at last, you know, we finally have something that's going to be played on the radio, and our careers will, you know, now we've made it to the big time. So it was a big disappointment when it never came out. This is all leading up to why I became a photographer, because when we sort of took a hiatus at that point, two of the guys in the Modern Folk Quartet said, we're going back to Hawaii, where we started, call us if anything happens. And in the meantime, on our last tour, I had picked up a camera. Actually, all 4 of us had bought these little funky secondhand cameras and started photographing each other and everything that we saw. We were in a camper going across the country doing college concerts. So there's plenty of stops and plenty of things to see, you know, and we all took photos of the whole thing for a couple of weeks. And when we got home to L.A., we had a big slideshow and invited all our friends. And here were all these moments, you know, on the wall, huge for all of our friends to see. And, I thought, my God, this is great. I mean, I fell in love with seeing these images blown up so huge on the wall. I didn't really know you could do that, you know. I guess I...
And this was, what, 64, 65?
66.
Uh-huh.
And so from the first moment we had our slideshow, I thought, my God, I'm going to take more of these things so we can have more of these slideshows. You know, because our friends all loved it. And among our friends were a couple guys that took photos, you know, as well, kind of amateur guys. And they were very encouraging. And so I set about, just about every day I would take photos. And, of course, then I was photographing all my friends, some of whom were unknown and some of whom were well-known, like Stephen Stills and Mama Cass and David Crosby, just the people I would come across during the day. And then I started getting calls from magazines at first, and then record companies, and kind of segued right into it, sort of accidentally. When I started taking pictures, the first group I shot was the Buffalo Springfield.
Oh, cool.
Just because Steven one day invited me to come down to a sound check down in Redondo Beach, and I thought, well, yeah, I'll come along because I want to photograph people on the beach to show in my slideshows. Uh-huh. I mean, it didn't even occur to me that I could photograph the Buffalo Springfield. Of course, they hadn't made an album yet, I don't think. I'm not sure, you know. I don't think their first album had come out yet.
So do you remember what they sounded like at their sound check?
Oh, well, funny thing, I didn't even go into the sound check. You know, it was probably a dark club, and at that point, all I knew was to take pictures outside. You know, I didn't have a flash or know anything about low-light photography. So while they were in rehearsing, I walked along the beach, and indeed, I got a great picture of a guy with a monkey on his shoulder, and they both looked the same. They had a little fringy beards that both looked similar. The guy had a crew cut, just like the monkey, and it was one of my favorite slideshow slides. And by the time I walked back to the club, I was photographing a big, colorful mural that was painted on the back of the club just as they walked out the back door, you know, finished with their sound check. And I said, hey, why don't you guys stand in front of that mural that I'm photographing, and I'll get you in the picture. And then I got a call from a magazine a week later saying, we hear you have a picture of the Buffalo Springfield. We'd like to give you $100 to run it. And I thought, oh, my God, you mean somebody will pay me money for doing what I can't stop doing anyway, you know?
Oh, and great. I know that was, I know that picture.
Yeah.
Maybe those of you who have the Buffalo Springfield box set, I think it's in there.
Yeah. And then, so that was kind of my, you know, entree to these teeny bopper, or that wasn't teeny bopper, but music magazines. That was Teen Set. And then someone from Tiger Beat called me at some point soon after that and asked if I would go down to the Monkees, you know, set TV set where they filmed the Monkee episodes and spend the day taking pictures of them. And I did, and it turned out that I knew a couple of the guys sort of from the Troubadour Club here in town. And but at any rate, I was their age, you know, and I had sort of long hair and love beads, and the guys that had been photographing them were sort of older guys that were AP photographers, and the Monkees didn't like them, you know. They kind of, you know, they kind of got in the way and tried to be pushy and make them do things, whereas I was, you know, a kindred spirit kind of, and just like to hang out and participate in the fun and just photograph whatever happened. So it was perfect, a perfect fit. And I spent the whole year shooting them almost every day on the set for these for magazines, and then I went on their summer tour. That would have been 67.
Is that the tour that Jimi Hendrix was the opening act?
Yes, it was. And you know, I got there a couple days after the tour began, and I flew to New York and joined them the very day that Jimmy left the tour. So I didn't get to see that, but I did get to hang out with Jimmy one afternoon and evening, you know. So, yeah, the Monkees were, you know, my first sort of real, you know, serious photo job.
And were your pictures used, like, in the Monkees trading cards and things like that? Or?
Yeah, they are on the Monkee trading cards. Well, they were used in those teeny bopper magazines. They wanted lots of color portraits of them because they could do, you know, full-page, you know, color portraits and posters,
sure.
Fold-out posters and magazine covers and, you know, and then, of course, they wanted photo stories as well of them, you know, horse playing and running around, chasing each other, and just all of that. I just basically just photographed everything I saw happening, you know, which is what I was doing anyway every day in my life, just photographing stuff from my slideshow. It was basically the same kind of thing, you know. So that worked out. That worked out really great. And a couple of years later, I repeated that same thing with the Partridge Family.
Huh.
Same thing, got called by a Tiger Beat magazine and spent the day on the set and got to know David Cassidy really well the first day. And then I became his photographer for a couple of years, went all over the world and stuff.
Well, wow, that must have been exciting.
Yes, it was.
Hey, we're talking, I just want everybody to know, we're talking with photographer and musician Henry Diltz, who took pictures of the Monkees, the Buffalo Springfield, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Joni Mitchell, and the Doors, and was the official photographer at Woodstock. Is that true? You were
Michael Lang hired me to fly out from L.A., and I spent I spent 2 weeks before the festival filming the building of the stage and all that stuff, and then of course the concert itself and the aftermath.
What was your experience at Woodstock?
Well, for the first 2 weeks, it was kind of like being at summer camp. You know, it was like beautiful upstate New York, you know, all the green trees and blue skies and all these hippie carpenters building this huge wooden deck in the middle of an alfalfa field. And the young hippie girls would bring lunch by, you know, and stuff. They had a whole crew of kids hired to do all this work. And I would just roam around photographing everybody, you know. And then one day, suddenly, there were about 20 people sitting up in the middle of this alfalfa field on the hillside. And it's like, what are those guys doing there? Oh, yeah, this is going to be a concert. I mean, you know, I kind of lost track of that fact, you know, in my reverie, you know. And then of course, and then the next day there was 2,000 people there, and then the next day there was, you know, 400,000 people there. They were early arrivals, and the thing was they hadn't built the fences yet. But these people arrived days early, and by the time they were ready to build the fences, it was too late.
And so, what was your impressions of the concert?
God, well, it was amazing. Of course, I mean, being the official photographer, I could stay up on stage or go any place I wanted to, and here was this huge crowd, which looked huge from the stage, but it wasn't until the end of the first day when someone brought in a New York Times and there was an aerial view. Then you went, oh, my God, you know, because you couldn't see that from the stage. You could just see lots of people, you know, going out in all directions. But when you saw that aerial view, you just was, you know. I mean, we didn't know we were making history, you know, until we were into the thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, it was great. I mean, it was...
Are there some really memorable photographs that you took at Woodstock? That...
Well, I loved the Janis Joplin pictures I took. I was standing on a little tiny walkway right in front of the stage so that my chest was right hitting the stage, which was built for the film crew. And I was the only photographer that could use it since I was Michael Lang's photographer. I think the picture of Jimi Hendrix, I say the picture, it's the only one I have left because the others have been lost or stolen. Out of photo labs and all, I mean, there are many stories about it, but I have one really great color shot of Jimi Hendrix standing there Monday morning playing, and when he played the Star Spangled Banner and it echoed, you know, against the faraway hills, and it was just that single guitar, you know, playing the Star Spangled Banner with all the sound effects. And when you looked out over the field that Monday morning, there was not so many people. They were just a clump of people right in front of the stage. And the whole hillside was full of these soggy sleeping bags, you know, wet sleeping bags and tents and blankets and stuff that people had left. And it kind of looked like those old Matthew Brady photographs of the Civil War battlefields, you know. You could imagine, you know, dead horses and soldiers laying out there and he's playing the Star Spangled Banner. It was quite a moment.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're chatting this week with rock and roll photographer Henry Diltz.
And one of my favorites, and one of your favorites, if you probably didn't know it was Henry Diltz's picture, is...
Whether you know it or not.
That's right. Is the cover of Morrison Hotel by The Doors. And that's one of the great... That's just one of the great album covers of all time. And how did that shot come about?
Well... Sometimes I think a lot of these album covers is almost sort of accidental, or if not accidental, very natural kind of. You know, that particular cover, The Doors had called us because my partner was Gary Burden, who was an art director, and the two of us had started doing covers together, and we'd done the Crosby, Stills, Nash, where they're sitting on the couch in front of that little old house, and I think The Doors had seen that or something, and wanted us to do their next cover. So we met with them in their little office, and it was actually just Ray and Jim were there. And we said, well, have you got a title? No, we don't. Well, do you have an idea, maybe, of what we might want to do here? We were just talking it over. No, they had no idea, you know. And at that point, Ray said, well, you know, my wife Dorothy and I saw this hotel downtown L.A. last week. We were just driving around, and we happened to see this old hotel that said Morrison Hotel on the window, and we thought, whoa, you know, that sounds great. So we immediately drove down, checked it out, and it was great, and we went back a few days later with the group to take the picture. We walked in the lobby. Now, this was a transient hotel, you know, basically a flop house. As the sign in the window says, rooms 250 and up, and it's $2.50, not $250 like it would be today, you know. But we walked in, and it was just a big empty lobby with some old furniture, and the guy behind the desk, a young guy, I said, we're just going to walk over there and take a few photos. We won't bother anybody. He said, well, no, you can't. I said, well, why not? You know, well, you have to ask the owner's permission, you know, and he's not here, and you got... I said, oh, my God. So we walked outside, and I thought, well, I can have them stand in front of the window. They can't stop us, you know. It's a public sidewalk. And we were about to do that, and I was looking through the window, and I noticed the guy leave the desk, get in the elevator, and disappear. And I said, quick, you know, run in there and just jump behind the window. And so they did, and we took one roll of film and got out of there, and that was the cover. So...
And what was your impression of Jim Morrison?
You know, most asked question, I think. You know, many, many people ask me that. I always use the word bemused. I mean, my one-word description of Jim Morrison is bemused, which implies, you know, a certain amount of attention and intelligence and interest, you know, and he was. He was a poet, basically, and he liked to hear people's stories, you know. He was very attentive to stuff that went on around him, and so he'd like to hear people tell their story, and he would kind of smile and nod his head, you know, that he was listening and taking it all in. It's not the usual impression that, you know, from the movie and whatnot. You think of a kind of a wild man always on acid or, you know, booze, which wasn't true, you know. I mean, we all, you know, used a bit of those things from time to time, but... Interesting thing, after we left the Morrison Hotel that day, it was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Jim said, well, let's get a drink. So we piled in the I think it was Robbie's Volkswagen van, and we drove down to Skid Row, which was just a few blocks away, and it was all bars and pawn shops. We didn't know where to stop, but suddenly, on the corner, there was a bar called the Hard Rock Cafe. So we said, okay, we got to go in there and get a beer. So we parked and went in. We spent about an hour inside drinking beer, and Jim was loving hearing the stories of these old winos that were in there. We sat at the bar. You know, there were no tables. It was just a big bar, and we sat in there, and these guys would tell Jim these stories, you know, and he loved it. He was smiling, nodding, and listening. And then they put the picture of the Hard Rock Cafe on the back of the Morrison Hotel album. And shortly after it came out, it was released, they got a call from England. And a voice on the phone said, would you mind if we use that name? We're starting a cafe here in London, and we'd like to call it the Hard Rock Cafe. And they said, no, go right ahead. And then that was the beginning of that whole empire. You
wow.
know?
So you could have had a piece of that.
yeah. You'd think. You'd hope. But that's okay, though, you know.
Well, and one of the great things about being able to talk to you right now is I can ask you this question. Mm-hmm. The cover of the Crosby, Stills, and Nash album. It's a classic cover. On the back, there's a screen door.
Yep.
Somebody behind the screen there.
Yep, and everybody always thinks it's Neil Young.
Who is it?
It's Dallas Taylor, the drummer.
And why didn't you come? Why don't you let him out? He was
Here's the thing. We actually, he wasn't the drummer when we took the picture. Or, you know, they hadn't even named themselves. We were just going out to take some publicity pictures. And we did. We were around West L.A. stopping here and there. And Graham had remembered this old shack with a couch. And we pulled up, and they sat on the couch, and we took the pictures. Then we looked at them a few days later. And meanwhile, within a couple days, they decided on their name, Crosby, Stills, Nash. But they're backwards in the picture. It's Nash, Stills, and Crosby. And I said, well, that will really be confusing, so let's go back and we'll just retake it. You know, I was a photographer. I said, it'll take 5 minutes, you know.
Yeah.
So we went back, and the house was gone. So first of all, they are sitting backwards on the cover because there was nothing else to do. Second of all, they decided about a week later that Dallas was going to be their permanent drummer, and they wanted him to sort of be a part of the group. So how could we fit him in there? So we took a picture of him in David Crosby's kitchen door.
So it's not even in the same...
No, and then Gary Burden stripped it in, you know. I mean, in Adobe Photoshop these days, it would take you 5 minutes.
Right,
back
how long
then,
did that take?
It took a week, and it took several $500 prints, you know, and re-photographing the print with him pasted in there. And then, you know, and then retouching and all kinds of stuff. But that's Dallas Taylor.
Well, how did the rumor start that it was Neil?
I don't know. I guess people just assumed. He does kind of look like Neil. He's got dark hair, you know. Funny.
Now, one of the most beautiful pictures of yours is one of your portraits of Joni Mitchell. How did you encounter her?
Oh, most of the pictures I took of her were up at her house, unless they were on stage. She was a neighbor of mine in Laurel Canyon. We both lived on Lookout Mountain Avenue. And she lived down lower, so that whenever I went up or down the hill, I passed her house. And several times I went by there to shoot publicity pictures of her, you know, leaning out the window or playing her dulcimer in the backyard or whatever it is. And she is a very gracious, lovely person and a true artist in the sense that, you know, many people are imitators and try to, you know, do whatever is current, you know. And she was an artist from the heart, you know, that made her own path and a real artist. I mean, she paints, you know, beautifully. And, of course, that was the house where Graham Nash had written that song, Our House is a Very, Very, Very Fine House. And it was, you know. So she was just a friend. A lot of these people were friends of mine from when I had been a musician. Like Stephen Stills used to come and listen to our group, the Modern Folk Quartet, play in New York City when we played at the Village Gate. He would come down and stand there next to the stage listening to our harmonies, you know. And then I met David Crosby and while I was on the road in the folk group, and he was singing in Les Baxter's Balladeers. And then I had met Neil as well, and we did some TV shows with the Mamas and Papas, so we knew them. So a lot of these people were friends of mine. And in fact, you know, one of the reasons I was able to become a photographer and take all these, you know, sort of intimate photos, I guess, or candid photos of these people is that I was sort of more of a musician and a friend than I really was a photographer. You know, I didn't come from the photography side, you know. I came from the music side, and I didn't act like a photographer. You know, I didn't ask people to move around and pose. I just kind of just watched and observed, you know, what they call fly-on-the-wall photography, you know.
And we'd all like to have been a fly on the wall in those days.
Yeah.
You were the one that got to do it.
That's right.
And you mentioned the Mamas and the Papas, and that's interesting because California Dreaming is the name of your book that's coming in November from Genesis Publications. It's a limited edition of, 2,000 copies, I believe.
Exactly, yeah.
And tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, it's a limited edition coffee table book. So there's 2,000 copies, all of them signed and numbered, signed by me and numbered. In fact, I'm just finishing signing. Let's see, I've signed 1,400 of them. I got 600 to go.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, they send me the pages, and then I sign them and send them back to Italy where they bind them into the book. And it's quite expensive. I think they're $600 or in that neighborhood of price. And they come in a box, you know. They put quite a few of these books out, and they're really beautifully leather-bound and fine books. And, you know, they come in a box, and they have... special, you know, features in them. They have deluxe editions that actually have photographs put in them and stuff like that. And so it's actually called California Dreaming and not Dreamin', you know, which the song is. And of course I thought, well, that's kind of a used again and again, you know, but they in England, they thought that just really described exactly what this book was, because it was about those years, the 60s and 70s, you know, when L.A. was kind of a renaissance of singer-songwriters, and it's such a special time that I understood why the English wanted to call it that, and, I mean, it's their publishing company, so I didn't fight them on it, you know. It's hard to come up with a name anyway, you know, or it's hard to... I mean, being in different groups, that's hard, too. You come up with a name for your group, you know. That is not easy, you know, or... or the name for your book, you know.
I know. I mean, what a coincidence that Crosby, Stills, and Nash actually were named that, and it was also the name of their band. That worked out good for them.
That did, didn't it? Yeah, they did.
Henry Diltz, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Sure thing, Gary. My pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.